This time on Weather Brains, we look at the latest tropical system in the Atlantic.
It sure doesn't appear that it's going to head directly for the U.S.
Plus, understanding climate change. We start a two-part Weather Brains special series with a man who has spent 30 years researching our planet's climate.
There are not two sides to the climate change problem. There are as many sides almost as there are competent scientists to comment on.
Plus, working in television weather.
This was the job I always wanted.
Jason Simpson's dream come true.
I always wanted to work with James Spann.
And when you're Jason, you have an early wake-up schedule. How early?
I usually get up about 2:30.
Plus, J.B. Elliott recalls the challenges of trying to get news and weather information in decades past.
I could not pick up a single Alabama radio station at night when I was growing up in Hale County.
That and more coming up. Welcome to Weather Brains, the podcast that is all about weather, put together by a bunch of weather geeks associated with the Weather Company from Birmingham, Alabama. I am one of those geeks, David Black, saying hello, and we are glad you are with us for this edition of Weather Brains. Also with us this time, J.B. Elliott of the Weather Company from Trussville, Alabama. Mr. Elliott, how are you, sir?
I'm clicking pretty good, although a little bit tired, but I'm clicking pretty good and happy as a lark.
Clicking's a pretty good term because rain gauges have been clicking around central Alabama. We're recording this on a Monday evening, and there have been some thunderstorms rumbling through. Jason Simpson with us as well. Jason, it's a rare treat, and we're excited to have you on board. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm great. I love the earlier start that we're taping. That way I don't have to stay up quite as late.
Yeah, we should probably explain to folks who listen to Weather Brains, Jason is not a real regular guest, but that's not a choice thing. You have to go to bed early because of your work schedule. What time do you have to roll out of the sack every morning?
I usually get up about 2:30, well, between 2:20 and 2:30. I start working at 3 at home, then I'm at the TV station by 4 putting everything together for the 5 o'clock show.
Now, working it's at home at 3, now we're watching Oprah. That's what we're doing, right?
Well, I don't know what you're doing at that time.
Yeah, what do you do working at home at 3 in the morning? You putting weather stuff together, looking on the web at weather?
Yeah, basically what I do is in the evening before, I usually spend about an hour and I make a rough draft forecast. It's almost like writing an English paper to me. When I worked the night shift back at my old TV station, I could do everything in one afternoon. But since we have a 5 a.m. start with Good Morning Alabama, I decided that I would use 1 hour in the evening and then 1 hour in the morning for preparation instead of 2 hours in the morning. That gives me a little bit of extra sleep. And sure, it takes away from the evening just a little bit, but it's not that bad, especially in the wintertime when it gets dark early.
So you do a little bit of work before you go to bed and then you kind of pick up when you get up.
That's the best way I've found to do it. I've worked the morning show now here for a little over a year and a half, and I've done it that way since day one, and it works out pretty well.
So how tough is it to get out of bed at that hour? Do you get used to it, or is it always painful?
You know, I don't think anybody could ever get used to a schedule like that. The thing that keeps me going is that I love my job. I could not imagine working at a better TV station. This was the job I always wanted. I always wanted to work with James Spann. Since I was just a little boy, and
that was a dream, huh?
It was, and not many people get to live their dream. And you know, of course, you wake up in the morning some days, and you say, I don't want to go to work. I don't want to do this. Then you start thinking about it, and you realize just how blessed you really are to be able to do exactly what you wanted.
And they actually give you a paycheck too, isn't that?
And they do. That's the best thing. You get paid for doing something you love.
They pay you weekly, very weekly, but they pay you. Just
big bucks.
Speaking of James Spann, he has a prior speaking engagement and could not join us for this show. That's why he is not with us on this broadcast. But speaking of unusual hours, J.B. Elliott, when you were in your longtime career with the National Weather Service, you guys worked rotating shifts all the time, right? 24 hours a day, 365 a year, right?
Changed every week.
Every week? Wow. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? One week you'd go to work at, what, 8 o'clock in the morning or something?
Yeah, 8 to 4 for a week, 2 days off. Go back to work at midnight, have 5 midnight to 8s in a row. Then 2 days off, and then 5-4 to midnight, and start the process all over again.
Occasionally, I complain about mine.
Wow. So what does that do to you when you have to make a change and work midnight until 8 once every, 3 weeks? How does your body adjust to that, or did it?
I'm not sure it ever did. I'll correct that. I really didn't have any problem with it because I was always the type of fellow that could go to bed and go to sleep immediately. If I had a chance to take a one hour to take a nap, I could sleep 55 minutes of that hour, so I was lucky in that respect, and I could sleep in daytime real easy, too.
I mean, so, I'm not going to say Jason has it easy, but at least, Jason, you got consistency.
So, oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Is that, now, what? Let me ask you this. I didn't mean to get too carried away, but this is kind of interesting. What about weekends? How do you, you know, Saturdays, Sundays, Jason, when does your body want to wake up?
Well, seeing as I'm still in my 20s, and our general manager, Mike Murphy, called. I was off last Monday. He called me at 8 a.m., woke me up out of the bed.
Oh, wow.
Because I still sleep on that teenager schedule on the weekends.
Ah.
I really do.
So you're out for the day.
I can go to bed at 8 o'clock on a Friday night if I've just had a really rough week or if we've had severe thunderstorms or something, and not wake up until 10 or 11 o'clock on Saturday morning. So I'm very flexible when it comes to sleep. The more, the better.
And I know when severe weather hits, I guess there's excitement, but I suppose there's a little bit of dread if you've got what's going to be a really long event, a flash flood event, or real slow-moving severe storm line, and you know you're going to be having to work. Same thing for JB, too, but you on the air, too,
yeah.
Jason. You know you're going to be on the air for 6, 8, 10 hours or more. And we've had some really woolly booger severe weather outbreaks in this state.
Well, I can tell you the absolute hardest thing that I've ever done in this business was Hurricane Katrina.
Oh,
because, and you know, I did my typical one-hour preparation the night before, but I went ahead and woke up about midnight. The night that, or the what was it? The was it a Monday morning? Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe it was. Yeah,
Sunday, I went ahead Sunday and woke up. Morning. Yeah, I woke up an hour early, so I was up at 1:30.
But you were pumped up too, because you.
Oh, I was.
It was a big event, but
you've got that adrenaline going. But and one of the ironic things about Katrina was that I was on air when it made landfall. Mm-hmm. In Plaquemines Parish, and it came across that southern tip of Louisiana.
Had to be exciting to be able to look at the eye on radar, didn't it?
That was incredible. It was incredible. You know, of course, I was there to witness the actual weakening of the storm, yet also knowing in my mind that storm surge wasn't going to change. But later that afternoon, about 10 o'clock in the morning, I put on a wetsuit and went down to West Alabama to cover the storm from Sumter County.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Castle, our chief photographer, and I ended up over in Lauderdale County, Mississippi, down in Meridian, where I used to work. And I did a live shot for the 10 o'clock news that night from the street corner of the building where I used to work on a live show on the big satellite truck there.
And as far inland as you were, I know you were taking a pounding from the weather even that far in.
Yeah, I would estimate that the strongest winds that we experienced in Katrina down there in Sumter County were probably between 60 and 80 miles per hour.
Meridian had a gust of 81.
Yeah, I was going to say it's tremendous wind over in Meridian. I don't think that Meridian ASOS gets the highest wind gust because I was there during Ivan 2, and I witnessed the roof start to peel off that building.
Sitting there watching that happen?
Yeah, while I was live on television, we had not lost power yet. I've got a lighting grid swinging above my head, and I said,
"And you're thinking about your insurance?"
No, I was thinking more about, I got to get everybody downstairs out of the top floor of this building so that this thing collapses, that we're all safe. But now, with Katrina, I think I was up for 40 straight hours before I got a break, and Ivan was about 36. So hurricanes are probably the most stressful thing on a meteorologist because, like you said, we get hyped up about it. We get that adrenaline flowing. And it's not that we're excited about death and destruction. We're not excited about that at all.
But it's a fascinating weather event.
If you just a hurricane spinning out in the middle of the ocean, that's a beautiful sight.
Yeah.
It really is, as long as it's not hitting land. When it hits land, it's ugly.
Right.
But out there in the middle of the ocean, it's just a wonder of nature. It's amazing.
I believe I went 30 straight hours on Ivan doing the radio cut-ins.
And you pulled a long time with Katrina too, right, JB?
Yeah. And I remember Jason coming in the wee morning hours that morning. He was so bright-eyed and fresh.
What do you guys, on Red Bull and coffee.
What do you guys do for sustenance when you're on that long? I mean, is somebody just bringing you burgers or something? You just take whatever you can finagle out of the vending machine down the hall?
We had no food over in West Alabama. Bill and I were able to get a Subway sandwich at Bology at the truck stop there before the power went out.
And that was probably
about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
A really good thing you could get that, I'll bet.
Yeah, and from there on, it was running on pure adrenaline. So from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until I got back to the TV station at 2 a.m., I didn't have anything to eat. And then after that, I only had the peanut butter crackers that I had brought to sustain us through the... I brought a whole bunch of groceries in just so that we'd have food in the weather office.
And Gary Kelly, the 3340 news director, is real good about bringing in sacks of stuff for you when you're... They're working continuously, like big sacks of sausage and egg biscuits.
He's great, but all that food was gone by the time I got back.
Yeah.
Because everybody else had already left.
I think in a television newsroom, there's a physical law that's in effect that you can bring in any amount, any quantity of food, and it will be devoured, and somebody else will be showing up hungry.
That's right.
But it is nice that people look out for you that way. That's a tough thing. You know, people don't realize just when you're in a storm scene like that, like you were, Jason, in East Mississippi, you take for granted all the products and services you can normally buy if you need them. You get low on gas. You don't think about any big deal to pull into a gas station, but they're closing and places are shutting down, and you can't get essential normal services and goods so much of the time in a case like that. It's got to be a real hassle.
Well, in the days after Katrina, I actually called the TV station down there because I've still got a lot of friends that work there and that live in Meridian. You don't work somewhere for 4 years and not make a lot of friends that you keep for a long time. And I was if they had not gotten some food brought in from another television station in their corporation, they're owned by Gray Television. If the TV station out of Dothan had not brought them something, I was going to load up with a bunch of Jim and Nick's and take it down to them because, you know, you can't leave people high and dry like that. And just like you said, no services, no gasoline, nothing. Yeah. And, you know, I talk about how bad I had it. You should hear some of the stories from that television station in the days after Katrina. Mm-hmm. None of those guys had power, and they were still trying to keep going on no sleep, sleeping in the floor because trees are still blocking the roads. Nobody could go home. And it's hero stories like that that you hardly ever hear. A lot of times you hear those of us who come back from it and go, man, that was bad. But when you are living in the middle of it, you know, if this had happened in Birmingham, we would have a completely different story to tell.
Well, and I have no doubt that this long after Katrina, where it has long since faded from the newscasts, there is still tremendous sacrifice and suffering going on that we just don't hear about. We just don't know about.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
I hear about church groups and others who are heading down to the coast to help with rebuilding, and how long is it going to take to really get back to normal, whatever normal is?
We had a group from our church that spent an entire week down there helping recondition somebody's church. And also, I've been listening to WWL a lot at night from New Orleans, and as they approach the first anniversary of Katrina, some very interesting information and very interesting telephone calls that come in.
Well, they were a tremendous station to be listening to while all that was going on. You have quite a history with that radio station, don't you, JB? You've listened to them in past years in major events.
I grew up listening to them in West Alabama because back in when I was growing up, it was so long ago that there was no such thing as FM stations, which reached out further. But AM stations, most of them either cut power at sunset or signed off. Stations in Tuscaloosa, for example. So I could not pick up a single Alabama radio station at night when I was growing up in Hale County. So I just grew up listening to WWL.
Yeah, they did a tremendous job with Katrina and have been around for many years. You really appreciate broadcast operations like that when big events like that happen.
Speaking
of some of the tropics like we've been talking about with Katrina, guys, give me a quick little run through on what's happening in the Eastern Atlantic right now. Looks like we finally got something happening out there.
JB, take it away.
Jason, you take it away. I've been dealing with this flash flood and thunderstorms tonight. I haven't even had time to check up on the tropics.
You've been on storm duty. I'll tell you, this morning I watched this wave come off of the coast of Africa. And looking at the satellite right now at 7:46 p.m., I think the last update was it's probably about 6 hours ago on this Eastern Atlantic view. That's a pretty impressive-looking little system out there, and it may already be a tropical storm based on the way the satellite looks. You know, there's a mental picture that goes along with what a storm should look like, what a depression should look like. And you know, if you just looked at this, a casual weather geek is going to look at it and say, wow, that's probably already a tropical storm south of the Cape Verde Islands, right around probably 11 degrees north. The good thing about this is that it's going to develop out there, and it's going to move into the central and then eventually the northern Atlantic and recurve out the westerlies.
So it won't be an issue for anybody this far west.
It doesn't appear that it will be. We still have the last time that I was on Weather Brains, I mentioned the negative SOI, the negative southern oscillation that's created kind of a weak El Nino, and that really enhances the westerly shear over the tropics. So as that westerly shear kicks in, it helps to recurve these things just a little bit farther to the east of the U.S. mainland. So at this point, it doesn't look like what Tropical Depression 4 is right now. Whatever it may become over the next few days, it sure doesn't appear that it's going to head directly for the U.S. But as James likes to say, and I know everybody on here likes to say, when it comes to thunderstorms, expect the unexpected. Hey, when it comes to hurricanes, tropical systems, it's the same kind of thing. These are governed under laws of nature, and sometimes we don't understand those laws completely. So right now, I would not believe that this has any impact on us at all.
Okay, but it sounds like certainly in the coming days, later on in the week here, when some folks are listening to these podcasts, that they won't be hearing about a depression anymore. It might be a much more developed system possibly by that time. So maybe the tropics are starting to pick up a little bit. So many folks have been saying, oh, it was a bust. And James Spann last show, I believe, pointed out and said, hey, don't say that this early in hurricane season.
No, but the technical peak of hurricane season, and Brian Peters and I were talking about this yesterday, the actual peak is September 10th. That's the day that we have the average storms at the highest. I guess you might call it the average occurrence of storms on that date is the greatest of any other time during the tropical season. So we've still got about 30 days to climb to that peak and then another 15 to 30 days to climb down from it. So roughly 2 months to go of the potential for a lot more activity. And as you know, we'll have to watch all these different things that are going on. But right now, you know, if somebody calls it a bust, it's probably not the best of ideas. But, you know, if we get on past mid-September and we still don't have much going on, then we may have to revisit that forecast again and lower the numbers even farther.
Yeah, but then so many things can happen between now and then, too. So
that's true.
I'm one of those people, I'll confess, guys, that I've been kind of wondering in the back of my mind, well, was it perhaps a little bit of an overly ambitious prediction for another real active season? But then I hear you guys and James say, hey, we're not through the season, and stuff can suddenly flare up in short term.
I believe I saw a report recently where the sea surface temperatures in the middle Atlantic are a couple of degrees cooler than they were at this time last year. So that may help some. And like you say, though, it's still way, way too early to throw in the towel.
You know, my honest opinion on the whole hurricane forecast is that I personally, and I won't speak for anybody else, I personally have difficulty picking out what's going to happen on the seventh day of my 7-day forecast, let alone trying to find out
exactly
a specific yeah. number of storms that are going to happen. And I think just like we've talked about that center line of a forecast track a lot mm-hmm. with hurricanes. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the National Hurricane Center has emphasized this year, don't look at the center line, look at the entire cone, because that's the margin of error. I think that people need to realize that there's a margin of error in any kind of forecast. And if we forecast, say, 95 degrees 7 days from now, we expect it to be between 92 and 98. Yep. I think that's a reasonable estimate. And with any kind of forecast of numbers, when you take a hard number like that, the chances of getting that one particular number are very small. So we got to give these guys a break. They've done a spectacular job forecasting this season. And whether it's a bust or not, they're sticking their neck out there and they're saying, here's what I believe is going to happen when nobody else is.
It is.
So got to give them credit for that.
It is so difficult to look way down the road and make anything even remotely specific, really, to make even something a projection that's even general sometimes can be tough. Every day we hear or read stories about climate change and what's sometimes called its likely effect on mankind and the planet we inhabit here. Speculating about the effects of climate change, yeah, that's pretty easy to do. It's being able to back up that speculation, though, with scientific fact, that's another task altogether. Dr. Bob Carter can tell us a lot about climate change. He has published over 100 papers on ancient environments, climate, and sea level change in international science journals. He spent more than 30 years practicing as a geologist, paleontologist, and as a stratigrapher, the latter being the discipline which enables the extraction of climate signals from layered sediments. He has analyzed sediments, get this, dating back more than 65 million years. That is older dirt than is in your backyard, JB. Dr. Carter has held numerous positions, including tenured academic staff at various universities in Australia, as well as serving on panels and committees involving marine science. He's currently a research professor in the Marine Geophysical Laboratory at James Cook University in Queensland, Australia. And that's where we caught up with Dr. Carter in the first of a two-part Weather Brain series we'll call Understanding Climate Change. Dr. Carter, what's your background as it relates to climate change?
My personal background, David, is I'm a geologist, and I think when one thinks about climate change, there are two different timescales that people have in mind. In the public discussion, it always concentrates very much on what I would call the short timescale or the meteorological timescale. Now, I don't want to run down instrumental records, but the reality is we have at most 150 years of meteorological data, by which I mean numbers that are collected, measurements that are made with thermometers. And for the last 25 years or so, of course, we have more accurate methods made, not on the ground, but made from satellites and weather balloons. Now, those records are very valuable about teaching us about meteorological processes and, to some degree, climatological processes, but they're not about climate change. To a geologist, climate change takes place over periods of thousands to tens of thousands of years.
So we don't have records going back that far to know anything about trends then, do we?
Well, you don't have meteorological records that go back that far, and that is indeed the big problem with resolving this debate. Geological records, yes, there are excellent records that go back that far and further. The two prime sources of those records, they both come from drill cores. One type comes from ice cores in Antarctica and Greenland. And the other main record comes from deep sea muds below the deep ocean seabed. And both of those records are layered. The mud accumulates in layers below the seafloor, and the ice accumulates originally as snow in layers on top of the Greenland or Antarctic ice caps, respectively. And because they accumulate as layers, they trap within each layer the climatic events at the time. So you can go back and make measurements of various features of each layer and reconstruct a climate, for example, temperature, change through time. Now, the records that we have in Greenland, for example, are very high resolution records with an annual resolution towards the top and a record back to about 100,000 years ago. Now, that's the sort of record in which you can pick up real changes in climate.
But I'm still hearing from you that our overall availability of data for knowing historical climate trends is rather limited. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, I don't think that's a surprise, nor is it in doubt. Yes, indeed, it is very limited. And that's not anybody's fault. That's just the way things are. We're extraordinarily lucky, living as we do at the turn of the 20th, 21st century, that we now have these modern, very clever methods of analyzing from resonance of oxygen molecules and things in the atmosphere, of analyzing temperature highly accurately and genuinely being able to average that across the world. But we've only had that capability for 25 years or so. And if you think about the way a meteorologist looks at climate, you'd be well aware that temperature curves are expressed as deviations from what is called the climate norm at a particular locality. And that climate norm is defined as a 30-year period. So, in a sense, meteorologists treat climate as things as a process that happens in 30-year bites. Now, we don't even have one 30-year-long bite yet of satellite data.
You're familiar with the British scientist James Lovelock, are you not?
I am indeed.
And Mr. Lovelock, of course, has had some rather dire predictions about the effects of global warming. He says that we are basically past the point of being able to reverse this. He says that we are beyond the tipping point, that we'll have a runaway greenhouse effect, and that people will be dying by the billions before the end of the century. What is your take on that assessment?
It's a very difficult thing to react to, and James Lovelock is not the only person that is saying that sort of thing. The reason it's difficult to react to is that James Lovelock is making that statement, in a sense, from his authority as a scientist. Yet the statement itself is not a scientific statement. It's a sociological opinion, if you like. It's rooted in science, I'm sure Dr. Lovelock would say, and in what he knows about the way climate changes and so on. So what my take is on that is not really the point. The point is, what is the evidence, the scientific evidence, for that statement? Now, science is about observation, experiment, and testing predictions. So back in 1990, when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change started going, we were treated to the first computer projections of what temperature would do over the next 100 years because of the increasing accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to worry about. It's a perfectly legitimate thing, sensible to set up computer models to try to find out if we can predict what will happen. Well, all the computer models, and they continue to do so, predicted that the temperature would continue to increase under the extra greenhouse forcing of that extra gas. And guess what? For the first 10 years or so, from 1990 through to about 1998, that did indeed happen. But since 1998, the computer models continued to predict that temperature should be increasing, and global average temperature has in fact flattened out. It is neither increasing nor decreasing since 1998 at a statistically significant rate. This is an example of science in operation. You worry about a problem, you make a prediction, and you test that prediction. Now, I put to you that Dr. Lovelock's arguments need to be tested in exactly the same way, and I am unaware of any substantial evidence that suggests his ideas would pass an empirical test.
You're well aware of the tremendous debate that has gone on in this country as well as around the world about global warming. Are you concerned that scientists on certain sides of this debate are being silenced through intimidation or censorship?
Before I answer the substantive question, let me just pick up the phrase you used, two sides of the debate. I think what that tells us is that the media are in control of the debate, because and that's scarcely surprising, they control all debates of societal significance. But they are preconditioned to present everything. Journalists are trained in journalism school to present everything as two sides to the question. You never provide the opinion of an expert without going and trying to find somebody who will put the opposing point of view. Now, that may, for some purposes, be a useful way to train journalists, but it's a disaster when it's applied to complex scientific problems such as climate change. There are not two sides to the climate change problem. There are as many sides, almost, as there are competent scientists to comment on it. So it's not a simple he says, she says argument. And I think presenting it that way, as the press do every day, does science a great disservice. It's a very complex argument. Virtually all scientists will agree that carbon dioxide, for example, is a greenhouse gas. and that therefore it has a tendency to warm the climate, other things being equal. But the devil is in that detail. Other things are not equal. There are all manner of feedback effects, such that the initial slight warming produced by the extra greenhouse gas may be either reinforced or cancelled out, depending upon what feedback effect you're looking at. And it's a point of completely legitimate scientific debate, which has been now going on for 20 years or more, as to the magnitude of that feedback effect. It's not a simple matter of either warming is happening or warming isn't happening. It's all to do with the magnitude. And the answer is, we do not know. The science remains profoundly uncertain. The computer models predict dangerous warming. But the science itself, the empirical science itself, does not support that so far.
And computer models leave a lot to be desired, do they not, in terms of their accuracy of projection?
Well, I'm a geologist, and you need to talk to a computer modeler about that. But seen from the outside, the computer models indeed seem to be, to some degree, exercises in curve fitting. They're very proud of the fact, for example, that they can simulate the actual temperature record of the 20th century now by using a powerful model. But that is a curve fitting exercise. And in terms of validating the models, by which I mean using them to predict into the future and then having that future come about, no GCM has yet been able to do that. So I don't want to be rude about computer models or computer modelers. They are very clever people, and the models are extremely clever constructions. But they are for discovering how the system works. They are not for making predictions with.
You're making me really do some serious thinking here, listening to your perspectives on this. And one question I have is, what sort of concerns, if any, do you have about the way climate change and man-made global warming is being presented to the public right now?
I've already touched on that in two ways. The first is, I don't think the press handle it well at all. Reducing it to two sides of a simple argument is not the way that it is. The second problem is that it's become a political issue. It's no longer a scientific issue primarily. It's become a political issue. And that is manifested particularly well at the moment by the film that your former Vice President Al Gore has made, and which is receiving wide publicity. That's a beautifully crafted film. Nobody who sees it can doubt Al Gore's sincerity in being concerned about the problems and wanting to communicate that concern to other people. But science is not about belief. Science, as I've said earlier, is about empirical testing. And virtually everything that is in that Al Gore movie has also come up in the newspapers or on television and radio over the last 10 or 20 years. All the things about more storms, more sea level, bigger cyclones are natural events. They happen anyway. Droughts, floods. And the question is, to what degree, if any, does human-caused global warming cause there to be more or greater or more dangerous events of that type? Again, a perfectly legitimate thing to worry about and a very sensible question to ask. But if you're a scientist, you then have to listen to the data that is relevant to the answer. And the data tell us that in no case can it be shown that those predictions are true. That is to say, that we will have more bigger storms in the future because of human-caused global warming. And I guess, coming back to the geological perspective, it is that the Earth is a dynamic planet. We live on a dynamic planet. We know every day the weather changes. And on the longer term, climate changes. It always has, and it always will. The fundamental misrepresentation that is being given to the public and politicians at the moment in the public debate is that somehow climate used to be stable before we started driving motor cars, and that climate is going to change in the future as though that was somehow something unnatural or undesirable? Well, it's neither. It's inevitable. Climate has always changed, and it always will.
Now, you might think that being able to publish your findings as a scientist looking into global warming is a relatively simple task. Well, not always, according to Dr. Carter, who tells us of at least one scientist who's had a hard time getting what he calls a balanced view on the subject published. And that scientist is Dr. Carter. He'll talk about that and what he calls a tremendous amount of propaganda floating around right now. That's next week in the second part of our series, Understanding Climate Change. Enjoyed talking to Dr. Carter. What did you guys think of him?
He was great.
I thought he was tremendous. I really enjoyed it.
He really helped me understand the complexity of the subject. And we really do tend to compartmentalize, simplify complicated issues. And his message here is you can't do that with some of this. You just flat can't do it without omitting huge, significant pieces of information.
He did a great job of boiling it all down to scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that everybody learns in seventh grade science. You learn scientific method. You find something, you make a hypothesis about it, and then you go out and test it and test it and test it until you know either it's true or it's false. And I think that's the proper way to look at it.
I think Dr. Carter handled it real well. I'm very anxious to hear his report next week. The big envelope of air surrounding this earth is so huge and flexible and fluid that it's almost impossible to put it in a box and try to analyze it.
Well, we enjoy talking with him and appreciate him working us in, and I do look forward to hearing from him in our next podcast. Guys, anything else we want to cover?
I just got cheated on the rainfall this afternoon. I don't believe I got more than 1/4 inch. You got all the rain, Jason. You and David.
No, David got all the rain. I got some beneficial rain for the brown spots in my yard.
We still have the notices in our water bills in some Shelby County communities to lay off the watering, but, you know, this has to have helped some. Hope so.
Hopefully so. Hopefully so.
Anyway, we'll hope for some more, at least, scattered storms as the week goes on. If you'd like to contact us here at Weather Brains, we would love to hear from you. You can do it a couple of ways, whichever floats your boat. If you want to leave a voicemail on our voicemail line, that number is area code 206-339-5482. 206-339-5482. Or if you want to just fire an email our way, our address is question@weatherbrains.com. For James Spann, who's not with us on this show, but we do have J.B. Elliott and Jason Simpson, want to say thanks to you two guys for being around. I'm David Black on behalf of the Weather Company. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us again next time for the next edition of Weather Brains. And remember, the opinions you hear expressed on this program are strictly those of the speaker and not necessarily those of ABC 3340. Weather Brains is copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Adios. Guys, enjoyed it. That was an enjoyable show. Thanks.
It was good. It was
enjoyable.
Good. JB, I'm sorry. I talked over you so much. I should have hushed.
No, you didn't talk over me. I talked over you. I don't ever know when to crank up.
Well, let's talk over everybody else and get into a discussion about this.
All right.
Just kidding.
I'm sure Dr. Carter will listen to this, won't he?
I suspect he will. I'll let him know that the show's on, and I suspect he'll tune it in.
Yeah. He'll probably think I'm a babbling idiot.
Well, he probably thinks that about me. He knows the
all
pros.
All of us.
He knows
all
the pros.
Yeah. See ya.
Bye. Bye.